In a universe that almost is, just out of reach beyond the edge of reality, mysterious forces underlie the fabric of existence. Energemetra 6, the very energy of creation, serves as both the elixir of life and the arsenal of destruction for its human and not-so-human denizens.
Crushing darkness, whose source they cannot fathom, grips the cosmos and its people. In anguish, they dream of the long-foretold bright star.
Join us as we embark on an epic journey, exploring the universe of Energemetra 6.
And here we are. Hey, Mel.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. So this is episode 16 of the Energemetra 6 podcast, and this is going to be the first episode where we're not reading something.
That's right. Well, I'll be reading off questions, but...
Fair enough. Well, thank you everybody for being here. I see we do have a few people who are live with us, and I'm going to hit the V for V ad real fast, and then we'll get to it. The Energemetra 6 podcast operates on a value-for-value model. That means that we hope if we provide some value to you in your life, that you'll return that to us in whatever way you can manage. If you're interested, head over to e6universe.com and sign up for our email list to get our free ebooks, and hopefully buy a physical book or some merch while you're there. Or if all you can manage right now is to leave us a good review somewhere, 5 stars or some kind of positive rating, that's more than appreciated. Thank you. And that's that. And so first off, actually before we get started, I just want to remind everybody, we are done with Bright Star. We've done Winter Night. We are going into From the Void, starting hopefully next week. So that's
exciting.
That's the agenda. Yeah, it is. And with that, I am at your disposal. What All you right. got for me, Mel?
All right. So the first few questions I have are more around what we've heard so far. Maybe a little bit of From the Void. It blurs for me a little bit because I've read both,
yeah.
So, and the latest installment as well. So it's all a little yeah. bit of a blur to me, but hopefully none of my questions themselves are spoilery. And if there's anything that I ask that that is a spoiler, feel free to indicate that. So the first few questions, like I said, are around the book series, and then the yeah. next set of questions are more general. Okay. So first question is the Retton Drive named after someone, or what is it named after?
Well, we have to go way back in Energemetra 6 history for that. And
okay.
none of this is terribly spoilery because I don't actually plan to ever release this content. I may someday, but it would require a complete rewrite. So I wrote the prologue to this book starting when I was 12, and it turned into 250,000 words, which is roughly 5 times the length of Bright Star. So I have a tome of history for the Energemetra 6 universe. And in that universe, Paul Kasizia met up with a guy named George Retton. And George Retton was kind of a genius. He was a scientist who managed to do some pretty extraordinary things, and he was the one who came up with the concept for the drive that they use on all of the spaceships that are currently in service in the Milky Way galaxy and coming out of there. Now, when they came to Aurora Galaxy, they had a pretty serious what would we call it, almost a dark age, where they kind of rejected a lot of the technology that they'd had before, and they started using other things. So the drives that they're using in Aurora are totally different, and they operate on different principles. But the Retton drive is a pure Energemetra 6-based drive that they use in the Milky Way galaxy. And because of the situation there. They actually never came up with any other models for it. It was kind of a sort of an arms race to get to that drive, and they both sides ended up using the same concept.
Huh, that's very interesting. Okay, cool. So next question is, are others capable of Extra B besides Nate?
Oh, now that is spoilery, but we could go there just a little bit.
Okay.
Let's put it this way. It's not... It's not that there is something impossibly different about Nate so much as that there is something intrinsically different about Nate. So just the fact that he naturally does that is pretty extraordinary, but it doesn't mean that it isn't possible that we could see something else like that happening with other people in the future. And depending on, now we're talking a ways out in the future, because for books 3, 4, and probably 5, I'm not sure whether I can make 4 and 5 one book, or whether it's going to be book 4 and 5. I know kind of what the story needs to look like. It isn't all written yet, but depending on what happens in those, it will be after that that the universe kind of opens up and we see a whole lot bigger picture of different people in different places. I'm doing a little bit of that with From the Void, where we see different people's stories, but really, my focus right now is building the foundation of the Energemetra 6 universe, which is Nate and his friends and their story. And then after that, I can expand out a little bit, and we will get to see some much more extraordinary things in some of the things that follow that. But first, I have to get there.
Well, that's exciting, too. Okay. Is E6 what keeps the odds from aging?
Ooh, that is a really good question. The answer is not entirely.
Okay.
And I'll let you in on a little secret here that most authors will fudge about a lot of times. I don't actually know what keeps the odds from aging entirely. Energemetra 6 does have something to do with it. There is also the fact that they are attached to the Milky Way galaxy in ways that they don't quite understand.
Oh, so that's interesting.
We've got, well, that it is. That's a big part of it. But it's a combination of factors. And there is one final factor in there that I haven't entirely decided how to come down on yet. So I know mostly what causes it. Energemetra 6 is part of it. But their linkage to the Milky Way is a bigger part of it. And it's because they have that linkage. They have that thing. Their systems, their worlds, their reality is a little confused about how it's how time flows for it, shall we say?
Okay.
I think it was in Bright Star that we just near the end of it that we just read that the Milky Way galaxy and the Aurora galaxy are traveling. They're moving at different speeds, which is what determines the time factor for those locations. And that's real physics. I mean, speed determines your relative, your comparative time. And so we know that one's traveling faster than the other. Now, the rest of it, I'm going to leave sort of as a mystery. How's that?
That's great. Now, I was really impressed throughout each of the stories with how accurate you are to actual physics. That really always is a sticking point for me when it's a sci-fi book that kind of strays from that.
this might get a little off track, but my philosophy on that stuff is kind of interesting. It goes something like this. If you're going to have a place where you make a fictional change to the physics or the way the world works, it needs to be as small as possible, and it needs to be consistent. And if you follow real world rules as much as possible and only change one little thing, then people are going to know what to expect and the whole thing makes sense. And the more you change and the more randomly you change it, the more magic you employ, the more difficult it is, at least for me, to immerse myself in the story. So when I do it, I try to be pretty careful about that stuff.
Yeah, no, you did a great job.
Well, thank you.
So is Paul Kazizia really gone for good?
That's a really good question. The answer is probably. The answer is probably yes. Mm-hmm. If we do encounter Paul Kazizia again, it will most likely be as a memory, as a ghost, as a callback to the past. I won't eliminate the possibility entirely, because if I get to the point where I'm writing that story and that just is what works, then mm-hmm. that's what I'm going to do. But my intent is not to bring him back in. But instead, you know what, and this is a little spoilery, but only in terms of what Rachel is going through, because mm-hmm. each of these characters is a person to me. They're not just a construct. They're mm-hmm. closer to real. So Rachel Kazizia really misses her dad. And one of the things that we as humans have to deal with is loss. We lose people and things, but mostly people who are really dear to us. And dealing with that is an important part of who she is and what she is. And I suspect that in the future, we will see that become a bigger part of her story. I mean, we already see it to a degree in the way she's relating to Nate, especially going into book two. We see that. I mean, I know you've read book two. We see that she's very much wants to go try to find her dad. Well, that tension isn't going to be able to hold forever. She will not be able to stop herself indefinitely. There will be a time where she just, for herself, she just has to do that.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes total sense. When will the next installment be set in time?
As far as book three?
Mm-hmm. Or book four, right? Or book...
Well, okay, so well, we've had... I'm calling the anthologies
half.
I'm making them halves because they're really not... They're not a full installment. They're like, you know, world building and mm-hmm. stories about characters. They're not a full installment. So it's technically so three, it's then. Book three.
Yeah.
It is set basically within days of the end of two.
Okay.
So there is no break. There is nothing jarring. It's exactly what you would expect it to be. And this will be a little spoilery for the podcast, but not terribly. When you get to the end of two, what it is they're doing at the end of two is exactly what they continue doing into book three. And, let's see. My current first line for book three is something along the lines of, Adamant charged down the gravity well like a mother grizzly to the rescue of her captured cubs.
Love it.
So that is only a tiny spoiler, but it's fun, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So moving to more general questions, how do you switch between writing about things like the E6 universe and sci-fi to writing about things like Neverwinter in more of a fantasy genre?
You mean Winter Night?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. I know where that came from too, and that's
sorry.
Fine. No, it's cool. The answer is I don't know exactly. So the timeline on this is a little funny. I wrote the beginning of Bright Star's story when I was between 12 and 17 years old. That 250,000 words I wrote back then. Then I put it aside for like 5 years and didn't do a whole lot of writing. I did some poetry, and there's one poem that was actually good that I wrote. I actually memorized it. I still remember it. But then when I was 22 or 23, I wrote Winter Night and its sequel. And I had not touched those since I was 22 or 23. I turned 39 in 2024. And then in, you know, 2022, I started working on Bright Star. So I haven't had to switch back and forth. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a really good question. I have a very good friend, one of the beta readers who actually has been a great big help, told me that he really loved Winter Night and that I need to recapture whatever it was I did there because he thought it was the best writing he'd seen from me. And I thought that was interesting, but Winter Night, to me, it's kind of more just moving from one way of thinking in my mind to another. It's like Winter Night is much more in the moment, much more present in whatever circumstances are going on all the time. It doesn't have nearly the, the sort of lost in your head kind of mental feeling that I employ when I'm writing Bright Star, and it's mostly because of the point of view characters. Okay, which is kind of interesting. When I put myself in the head of Nate, it takes one side of my brain and kind of goes nuts with it. And then when I put myself in the perspective of Talina or her friends, it's a totally different way of thinking because she's a totally different person. And that's the best way I can describe it.
Okay. I think that kind of gives us a good idea.
Fair enough.
So how do you overcome writer's block? Or do you have to overcome it?
You know, writer's block for me takes a very strange sort of form. It's like, I actually have a really easy time with the story, with the laying out the tapestry of how things all go. Mm-hmm. What I have problems with is in the story I'm writing right now, in book three, I'm at this place where they come into a room and something is happening. And when you eventually read it, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about because it's a big deal. And it has to be kind of an important occasion. It has to be kind of shocking. It has to be kind of in your face. It has to be a little horrifying. And so the last 2 days when I sat down to write, I kind of just stared at the screen. And it wasn't exactly what I would term writer's block. It's more like trying to figure out the why behind the scene enough to get something that is appropriate for what you're going into. So once I understand what's going on properly, it kind of tends to flow naturally. And then I have those days where I just don't feel like doing anything, which we all have. And on those days, it's a matter of just sit down, make yourself put down some words on the paper. The first ones are going to be garbage. Go back, rewrite them, try again. Okay.
Got it. That's great. Who are some of your favorite authors?
So when it comes to important writing, when it comes to writing that has substance to it, far and away it's C.S. Lewis. And so when it, you know, a lot of his writing, whether it's his nonfiction stuff, and I highly recommend books like The Great Divorce or Mere Christianity or, you know, any of his nonfiction. They're deep, they're thought-provoking, they're important. Mary and I reread one of them together just recently because it really does. It's some of the most weighty stuff you can read that also comes from a fiction author. You know, there are a lot of nonfiction authors who have very weighty stuff, but that comes from a fiction author. And then you read some of his stuff like The Last Battle in Chronicles of Narnia, and some of the concepts that he puts into The Last Battle, whether it's further in and further up, which is the theme of the book, like, yes, eternity is about growing constantly up into something greater and better and more beautiful before God. That's incredible, the way he, you know, the way he presents it. It's really cool. Or whether it's the dwarves at the table who are sitting at a banquet table in reality, but because of the reality that they perceive, they see themselves as sitting in a nasty stable eating little rotten leaves of lettuce and stuff. And the point he's making there is that reality is what we choose to make it a lot of times. God does not enforce his reality on us. He allows us to see what we choose to see. And that is true to the point of total delusion, which we see a lot in the world around us, and C.S. Lewis did a great job of presenting it. So far and away, it's C.S. Lewis. When it comes to more fun stuff, mm-hmm. I like... You know, there were authors who had a particular time in my life where they were really impactful. Like when I read Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, I connected with that book. Mm-hmm. I connected with it, and it was important to me for a time. And he's a good writer. I like Orson Scott Card. There were books by Heinlein that I really liked at a particular time. When it comes to just for fun stuff, though, I like David Weber. I like John Ringo. I like Dakota Crout. It's all brain candy, those ones. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it just depends on what you're reading at the moment. The only thing that I've had time to read over the past few weeks is actually the Bible. And I got a chronological Bible for Christmas, and I've been reading that. And that's kind of a new way of looking at that. So that's cool. And
that's cool.
I should say, of any books that I read, the Bible is by far the most important, which, that should be obvious, but it isn't necessarily. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Awesome. Let's see here. What advice would you give to aspiring authors?
Manage your expectations. So, you will not publish a book and become the next Stephen King or Brandon Sanderson. That isn't the way life works. The way life works is you put years of your life into something, and then maybe, if you get good at it, you have a chance at succeeding in a significant way, and it probably isn't Harry Potter way. Like, the chances of publishing a book and being successful are lower than almost anything else. The only way I would say to write a book is if you're essentially compelled, like it's actually something that you have to do or you become unwell. Like Andrew Clavin likes to say, he says, you're not a writer because you write things. You're a writer because if you don't write things, you become unwell. And I'm with him on that. That's sort of the way it's been for me. So only do it if it's that, if it's for your personal satisfaction, or if you feel like you have a compelling reason to do it. Those are the only reasons that I find rise to a level to do it. Or maybe if you enjoy it. You know, there are people who actually enjoy the act of writing. And if you do, more power to you, that is awesome. Most of us don't. Most of us just do it because it's important enough to us, or we kind of have to be okay. And that's kind of, I don't know, maybe that's a dirty secret, maybe it's not. But my advice to aspiring authors is manage your expectations. Know why you're doing what you're doing. And then if you decide it's worth it, don't give up. It took me 250,000 words, 5 copies of Bright Star, 5 of these, to get to where I could write something fictional that was even okay to read. And it took another 20 years of life experience and more writing in other areas. Like I have a degree in journalism. So I've done a whole bunch of nonfiction writing in my life. And it took a whole lot of it in order to get good enough at it to be able to do something that was worth having other people read. It's hard. It's a craft. It's actually, I'm not that good a writer. I know it. I'm working at it. I'm learning. I'm getting better. But I'm not a master of the craft. And so I would say only jump into it if it's something that you really, really want to do. So don't think that it's something it's not. There's a lot of people who I've met at these writers' conventions or whatever who, you know, they published something 10 years ago and they like the aesthetic of being a writer, but they're not really writing. And I would say don't do that to yourself. Don't fool yourself that way. It's not a good thing. If you're going to be a writer, it's hard work. It's very little inspiration, mostly hard work, and it's a craft that you have to master. So know what you're getting into and be intentional. And when you get there, you know, it'll be 10 years down the road. There's no easy or fast way to get there.
Mm-hmm. Well, that seems like good advice just in general.
It is, but you know, when it comes to writing, people who have the capacity to be writers are also fantasists. They have these fantasies in their heads about what they can and can't do. And that's great, but don't fool yourself, because you're going to hurt yourself.
Hmm. Okay. What is your favorite part in your books?
The world building, far and away. And if you read like Veil of Mysteries, there's a part in there where I go back into the history of the universe and I start, you know, talking about a little bit of the prologue that I wrote once upon a time. Mm-hmm. And Nate tells a story, and it's pure world building, and I really enjoy that part. And, you know, I get to do that in the short stories. I get to do that in where actually doing it in the novels, it's, you know, it's a little bit less and not as dense. So that's by far my favorite part.
Okay, awesome. And this is my last question, so after this we can go to chat to see if they have any. Okay. What is your process for developing a story?
Okay, so I have a little bit of a funny anecdote here. I was sitting in a grocery store selling books a few weeks ago, and I had this girl come up to me, and she had to tell me her idea for a story. And at this point, I don't actually remember what the idea was, but what I remember is we got about 2/3 of the way through her telling me, and I'm trying to be patient, and, you know, I'm trying to connect with her, because what matters to me is her. And so I'm listening, and we get partway through, and she looks at me, she says, "You're going to steal my idea, aren't you?" I don't even know how to start with that. The ideas are the easy part. So about once a day, I get an idea that could be a really, really good story, a really good novel, a really, you know, spectacular idea. The ideas are the easy part. So when I get an idea that is worth pursuing, or that sticks with me for long enough, or strikes me hard enough that I think it's valuable enough to record it, I sit down at the computer and I will type out probably 2 paragraphs worth of just, you know, idea, 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 idea. This is how it all connects together. And then I forget about it for a while. And then it'll come back to mind, or I'll dig it up and go back through it or whatever. And I will go, okay, so that's interesting. And it'll develop a little more. And it'll develop a little more. And you know, I give it time. And then eventually I have a seed of something that's worth going with. And eventually I will bring it to life. Or in the case of a character from the stories, like, you know, you read some of these short stories. And in From the Void, we've got 5 different short stories. One of them... One set of them, the ones about Tom Neelian, I really wanted to write. Mm-hmm. And that's why they're in there, because I really wanted to write them. I really wanted to share his story. He doesn't really come in until near the end of book 2. He isn't a major player until after book 5, but I really wanted to tell his story. And so I am bringing him in. And so that's why I did it. It's because that idea was germinating for long enough and I liked it enough that I wanted to do it. Then you get other stories like the ones, one about Keeper of the Mysteries, Taryn Galton, which I kind of needed an intro to the Bright Star universe before I had book 2 or before I had From the Void or anything. And so I'm like, okay, what can I do? Well, you could write a little short story from right before Bright Star appears on the scene. Well, what would that look like? So that one was kind of directed. It was kind of necessary and needed. And so I put it together from the pieces, but it was kind of just like writing a previous chapter of what had already happened. Same is true of the ones with John and Rachel. I enjoyed writing the stories, all 3 of them, but they were kind of necessities kind of important more than they were just inspiration and something that I really wanted to get down at that time.
Sounds so like a lot of patience is needed there.
There is. And I would say that the biggest thing, to me at least, is, and this might actually surprise people, it's that constraints make your story. And I'd actually like to talk about that a little bit. I don't see any questions in the live chat. So if you're watching, if you're interested, if you have a question, definitely drop it in chat. I would love to answer it. I do have them open here for both Rumble and YouTube. What I was going to say, though, here is constraints are actually the most helpful part of writing a story. And what I mean by that is a lot of people think that being creative is just about sort of letting your mind go wild. And that's not really true. It's like we talked about with physics. Having actual rules that govern your universe are important, but even more so, having actual rules that determine what your story needs to look like are equally important to having a good story. So let me give you an example. The one about the Keeper of the Mysteries, most of the rules of that were in place for me before I ever sat down to write it. I knew where it kind of needed to end. I knew who the main character was going to be. I knew kind of what he was up against. And so it kind of wrote itself in some ways because the constraints just made the story be what it needed to be. The interesting part was, how does he relate to this? Who is he? Because that's what you find out, is you find out who the people are in these stories. If all you want is a timeline, write a timeline. Don't write a story.
Right.
So constraints are actually really important. And at some point when I finish the Epimyth, I want to do this again in some form, and I want to talk about what the constraints behind the Epimyth were in a much bigger way. Because it's actually important, but in the meantime, let's get into that just a little bit right now, if we could.
Okay.
So, this is something I've been thinking about. You know the name Jordan Peterson at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way he talks to people a lot of times is he doesn't just give a lecture. He actually thinks something through with his audience. And I don't know that I think fast enough to do that, but this is something that I have been thinking through lately, and it's actually a big part of the reason why I'm writing now. It's a big part of my why. And that is, when we think about narrative, when we think about stories are a big part of what drives us. They're a big part of what determines how we live our lives. So there are a couple different examples. One of them I like to give is when I first started the Twitter account for Energemetra 6, I had a guy post a tweet that said, "Some dudes choose one book and make it their whole personality. For me, it's Starship Troopers." And that's kind of an amusing quote. I mean, it's cute, but really, it does point to something important, that whether we know it or not, and this is true for me, this is why I named Ender's Game. When we find a story that calls to us, it kind of gives us a way to interpret our lives. It gives us like a Rosetta Stone for who am I and what am I doing and where am I going in my life. And when you have a society where every story is about the anti-hero, it's about the, it's gritty and it's kind of negative and it's about the guy who kind of does the things and he's, you know, maybe he's all twisted up, but if in the end he's not the good guy who like wins the battle and gets the girl, which is sort of the traditional formula, right? It's like, that's how it always was. It sends a message to your whole society. Narrative is sort of the battleground on which any kind of battle is fought. Mm-hmm. Before you go do something in your life, you have a reason for doing it. When you get up out of bed, you have a reason for that. You don't just do it because you know, maybe you got to go to the store, maybe you got to go to work, maybe you got this, maybe you got that. You have a reason for the things you do, and that's all kind of a narrative in our minds. And so when we have a narrative that is broken, when we have a narrative that has a lot of lies in it, mm-hmm. it damages the whole way that we interact with the world. And I when I look at the fiction that my kids have to read, there's nothing on the level of Chronicles of Narnia that gives you a framework through which to live your life and have it be healthy. It's like in that context, those kids were the heroes of the story, but they also had this whole context they were operating in. And they weren't just able to do anything and everything. They had to do good things, because when they did bad things, there were bad consequences. And when you have those lessons in a story, all of the good lessons that we transmit down through our society via our stories, that is the most important thing that a writer can do, is to base their work on good things and tell good stories. And that doesn't mean that there isn't a place for the brain candy, because I love brain candy as much as anybody else, right? I was saying so. But we still need those important stories. And so that's what I really care about. And we can take this all the way back. You know, I am a Christian. I believe in Jesus Christ. And I believe that the original thing that messed up our world was a lie. And it was a lie that took a narrative and it diverted it from a good course into a bad course. And that one little lie sort of created all of the heartache and misery that has ever happened in the history of time for humanity. Mm-hmm. That's a big deal, man. We need to be basing our lives on things that point back to the truth.
Absolutely.
And we're at 37 minutes, and I know we've gone a little longer than we normally would, but thank you, Mel. I sure appreciate this.
Thank you. This was great. It was really interesting getting to dig through your mind a little bit and see where things are going with the story.
Absolutely. And I'm looking forward to giving people the next iteration. I've got a couple of things I'm working on right now that are still details. I've still got a little bit of web design. I've still got a little bit of, make work on the books that I need to get. I need to just fix a few things. But then I can actually get back to writing for a couple of months, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm almost there.
Sure.
Awesome. Well, in that case, anything else you got here?
That's it for me.
Cool. Well, thank you, everybody. I appreciate everybody who's tuned into this, and we will catch you next week for the beginning of From the Void, and I'm looking forward to Mel being able to narrate for a while. That's going to
we'll
be
see
fun.
How far I don't think I'm going to get as far as you do normally, but we'll see.
You know what? It's okay. What we'll do is we'll go to a good stopping point, and we'll call it and pick it up the next time. It's
Sounds
not a
good.
Big deal. It's awesome.
I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. All right. We'll catch you then. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Bye.